Right, okay, ladies and gentlemen. This week we have a special guest in the name of Gary Aylott. That's how you say your name, Gary, is it?
It is, yep.
And Gary is part of the Doctor Who podcast, the Big Blue Box podcast. Now, bearing in mind, I've been on a heavy drinking session this weekend. That is quite difficult to say. So before we get into the episode properly, Gary, I was just for those people who may have been living under a rock since 1963, can you give us an idea of what Doctor Who is and what the basic premise of the show is?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, thanks for having me on, Kurt. It's very, very kind of you, mate.
No problem. Thank you for coming on. It's much appreciated.
Doctor Who is, like you said, for anyone that's been under a rock for the best part of 50-odd years, it's a science fiction show that's centered around a character called the Doctor, who is a Time Lord who is, as the name suggests, travels through time and along the way saves Earth many, many times and other planets and teams up with other cool people. And just general sci-fi shenanigans, really.
Why Doctor Who and not Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica and Lost? What really draws you to Doctor Who to do a podcast on?
Well, that's a big question.
We've got loads of time. Take your time.
So, I mean, I've been a sci-fi fan for all my life, really. And my sort of two main loves, if you like, of sci-fi are Star Wars and Doctor Who. Okay. And the reason why I didn't do a Star Wars podcast is because there's just a million Star Wars podcasts already. And although there's a lot of Doctor Who podcasts, there aren't as many. It's a bit more niche, I would say, in terms of sci-fi. But the reason why I leaned towards Doctor Who was for two reasons, really. I think the first one was it's one of those sort of quintessentially British shows. And, you know, us being Brits, it's cool to have like a sci-fi show and a sci-fi hero that's sort of on home turf, if you like. And it's always been like very, very British. So that was, you know, one of the main things. And the other thing was, it's just something a bit different than, because you mentioned Battlestar Galactica and, you know, I've mentioned Star Wars and so on. Those things, although they are different, but things like Star Trek and Star, you know, they do have a common sort of outer space theme. You know, a lot of it is set on, you know, big spaceship somewhere in space, and it's, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas Doctor Who is just nothing like that at all, really. You know, like the Doctor's ship is a public phone box from the 50s or 60s, and, you know, the Doctor doesn't use weapons, and, you know, it's a lot of it's set on Earth and other planets and stuff. So it's just totally different to any other sci-fi that's out there, I think, anyway.
Yeah.
So it just provides a bit more of a, not just doing a podcast, but just as a fan, just appreciating the show and watching it and so on. It just provides a bit more of a, something different, you know, that we haven't seen before. And that's been the case throughout the entire show's history, even more so now when we're branching out into new areas with, you know, the new Doctor and stuff and being a lady and all that stuff. And, you know, it's always changing and pushing boundaries and stuff. So it's very unique.
And when you say it's unique, and you mention the blue box, for those people who don't know, as I say, who have maybe been living under a rock, but the TARDIS is effectively the spaceship that's used, and say it's like an early 60s police phone box, which would be no bigger than a cupboard, effectively. But when they walk in there, you know, the whole thing is bigger on the inside, and that's a running gag for the show. And for me, I think that for Doctor Who, over the course of its entire run has been because it's so unique and you know, British, it can be anything it wants to be. And I think that's one of my things that I particularly like about the show is the fact that you can have an X-File. I'm always going to go back to X-Files because X-Files is my favourite show. And, you know, by the time episode 5 comes in, they'll be sick of me saying it. But it could be an X-File, or it does have some Star Trek connotations. I think I'll get into that a bit later on with one of the episodes I want to touch on. And it has that sci-fi concepts in it all, but it also has some real, like, grounded, almost soap opera aspects to it as well. So, yeah, I totally get the reason for that. And one of the things I was going to touch upon was the fact of how ingrained it has been in British culture. It was on air from 1963 to, I think it was 1989 in its first run. So had this British culture of everyone knew what a Dalek was, or everyone knew about hiding behind the sofa. It was one of those things that parents used to tell the kids and all those type of things. I mean, what was your first recollection of Doctor Who from that aspect? Where did you come into it from?
Yeah, so I actually, before I go on, I'm glad you mentioned The X-Files, because that's one of my favourite shows.
Right, okay.
So there'll be no, I won't get sick of you talking about that. But I think I came on, I came into it fairly late, to be honest with you. I mean, I was always aware of it. Like you say, it's almost like it's ingrained into sort of especially British pop culture. And it's one of those things that's always, even if people don't like sci-fi or if they haven't been a fan of Doctor Who before, especially the older generation, they'll always tell you that they know of it. You know, they know the show. They know it's something about the Doctor and all that stuff. So growing up, I was always aware of it, but I don't know what it was. Something, it just didn't pull me in the same way that something like Star Wars did, or the X-Files, as an example.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why that is, because right now it's, you know, for the past 4 or 5 years, maybe 6 years, it's been such a big part of my life, and I love it so much. And it's weird that I didn't have any of those feelings before when I was younger, and I can't explain that. Just something about it just didn't attract me at all.
Right. Well, that's interesting that you've come to it a bit late. One of my recollections, and I was looking into this today just as a bit of research, that I remember Sylvester McCoy. That's the Doctor that I remember the most. And I hadn't realised that was effectively the last Doctor before we got the reboot in 1996 with the film, and then obviously 2005 with it's the modern era of Doctors. And I don't remember much about it. I just remember it being on. I remember it being a quirky guy. I remember Bonnie Langford on the show, and that's about it. And I still to this day wouldn't be able to say what monsters were in that on that week or whatever. But it was certainly something that whenever anyone say asked, you know, when I was growing up, you know, do you remember Doctor Who? It would be yes, I do. I do remember it. I just don't remember what the actual finer details were. So when the 1996 one came around for me, it was. Right, I'm going to watch this. I love sci-fi. I love my X-Files. I love Star Trek. I love Battlestar Galactica. I love Lost. I love all. Very much a sci-fi type person, and I gave it a go. And obviously, it didn't really take off. But I remember quite enjoying it. It was fine. And then obviously, the 2005 one comes around. But before we get into the modern era of Doctor Who, let's start talking about your podcast. So the Big Blue Box podcast. That's the last time I'm going to say it. Okay, so your podcast, as we speak now, is 206 episodes long. You started in March 2014. How did that podcast come to be? What was the events surrounding the actual getting the podcast off the ground?
The rewind time a little bit now. it's a bit fuzzy. I think I wanted to get into podcasting because I had, for about a year before that, or maybe 6 months before that, I had found I'd heard of podcasting for a few years before I started mine. And it wasn't until about a year before I started mine, I really started to look into like the podcast directory on iTunes. And I was amazed at how many cool, even in those early stages, because, you know, as you probably know, podcast grows every year. Every year there's, you know, a thousand or, you know, 5,000 extra shows that get made every year, and it's growing really fast.
Yeah.
And back then it was not as popular as it is now, but it was still like a thing. It was a cool thing.
Yeah.
And I had discovered some Star Wars podcasts and a couple of other things. And I thought, this is really, really cool. And I just enjoyed sort of absorbing all of that stuff just as a listener, really. And then it got to the point where, after I've been into Doctor Who for a little while, I thought, you know, I want to do something, you know, as a fan that's a bit more than just every now and then jumping on Twitter and saying that was a cool episode, or, you know, I just wanted to do something more. So I started, you know, churning ideas around. Do I want to do a good old blog that was just written articles, or did I want to do a YouTube channel or whatever? And I thought, you know, let's give this podcasting thing a go. Cause I'd done sort of music technology as A levels at school and stuff. So I had a background in sort of music tech and that stuff.
Right.
So I thought, well, let's give this a go. You know, I've got a couple of basic microphones knocking around. And like I said earlier, initially I was thinking, do I want to do a Star Wars one? Because I'm a huge Star Wars fan, but there's like a bajillion Star Wars podcasts already. And let's do Doctor Who, you know, because I'm into it now. I love it. So I did the first couple of shows. Well, actually, I think I did the first 7 or 8 shows, just me, just solo, just sat in front of a really basic. I got one of those. A lot of people get them when they start out. It's called the Blue Snowball microphone. Yep. It's like a white baseball, it looks like. So I just grabbed one of those. I think it was like 50 quid. No mixer at that point, nothing, just straight into the computer, and sounded dreadful. And just started waffling about Doctor Who, really. I think I tried to get some kind of structure in early. So I tried to do like a bit of news and then reviewed an episode. But it was really bad. Those early ones, they were proper, just really basic. And yeah, I cringe when I listen to those early ones now.
So worth a listen then.
If you want to laugh, go back and listen to those first sort of dozen episodes. And then I think my co-host Adam, I got him on as a guest quite early on. I think it was episode 7 or 8, I think. Right. I got him on as a guest just because I was aware of the fact that it was just me talking rubbish for an hour or an hour and a half at the minute. And I don't think that was, it went down okay. I got some good feedback, but in my own mind, I was thinking, I don't like the sound of my own voice, so nobody else is going to like it. So I thought, let's get some people on and mix it up a bit. I got Adam on early, and the feedback after that show with him was really, really good, because he had already had an established sort of YouTube channel where he did sort of reviews and unboxings and stuff, mainly Doctor Who stuff.
That was the Geeky Handbag, is that right?
Geek's Handbag.
The Geek's Handbag.
That's it, yeah. So he had already had like a cool following and, you know, really cool. I loved his YouTube channel. That's why I asked him on, because he seemed like a really cool guy and he knew his stuff about Doctor Who. And after that show, we got really good feedback, and I think I did another one or two shows after that solo. I was thinking, and I thought, why don't I ask him? I thought, he hasn't got enough to do. He hasn't got a life of his own. Let me just grab him and see what he thinks. So I messaged him and said, we got really good feedback after that initial show. Do you want to jump on as a permanent co-host, and we'll do it as a tag team? We'll do it as a, you know, proper show together. And he was up for it. He was really excited. He was like, yeah, that'd be great. Let's do it. And the rest is history, as they say.
Okay. And then 200 episodes, we're now talking about season 11, isn't it?
11.
So we're talking about season 11. You mentioned there that that you using the white snowball, which a lot of people go down the route of that, or getting the Blue Yeti. And eventually, over the time, we talked off air just before, and you were saying that you use a mixing desk. And the people that I've interviewed so far haven't gone quite down that route. Can you just explain, just briefly, in fairly layman's terms, I probably know what you're talking about because of my music background, but how that all comes together when you're putting a podcast together using a mixing desk rather than just plugging a USB straight into a computer?
Yeah, so when I started out, like I said, I had that Blue Snowball and it went straight into the computer. And what I used to do was record just my vocal track as a single stereo track. Yeah. And then I've always used a program called Adobe Audition. And so I'd record my vocal track, and then after I'd finished recording, I would then go into the multi-track view and bring in like the separate intro audio clip, the outro clip, and any sort of episode clips or anything like that in between, and sort of fade my vocals in and out. And it took quite a while. I used to record, I think back then, for about an hour and a half, and it used to take me that again to edit it. And I thought, no, there's got to be an easier way. And I was doing some research, and I found this YouTube channel of this guy called Cliff Ravenscraft. I think he's more popularly known as the podcast guy. So what he used to do, he used to set up these packages where he'd say, right, here's, I didn't buy this, but he'd sell these packages where you got a basic mixer and a microphone and an external recorder. And he also did these YouTube videos that went along with it. And when I watched one of those, my mind was blown, because the way he did his podcast back in the day was essentially like a radio, like a live radio show. As soon as I saw that video, I adopted that way of doing it. So I picked up a mixer, picked up an external recorder, a much better microphone, and I got an app on my iPad, which is like a soundboard where I can load up all of my clips So what I do is my main microphone, sorry, goes into my mixer along with my iPad, and they're my two main input channels. And then I also have the audio from my computer going in there as well, and that's my Skype feed. So when Adam records, we record over Skype, so his audio comes in via Skype along with my microphone and my iPad, which has got all my sound clips. And then what I do is I've got a cable that runs from there and it goes into an external audio recorder, which is my Roland R-05. So that records everything coming out of the mixer. And doing it that way, like a live radio show. So on my iPad, so as a really basic example, when Adam and I are ready to record, I hit the record button on the external recorder, press the intro clip on the iPad, and that starts playing the intro music. And then I bring the, literally on the mixer, I bring the fader down. We start talking, we get on with the show. And then when we play clips, I bring them in live. And so there's two advantages to doing it that way, essentially. So I can control everything on the fly.
Yeah.
So it makes it a bit easier. So if Adam waffles on for a bit longer than usual,
you can fade him out.
you've given me an idea. I can delay bringing in one of the review clips, or if, you know, we miss a beat somewhere, you know, it's just easy for me to sort of judge how, if things are going live. And also, secondly, it just saves so much time afterwards. So I don't have to spend an hour to 2 hours in Adobe Audition with the multi-track, bringing everything in and fading vocals out and all that stuff. The only thing I have to do is bring that audio into Audition afterwards and just apply some compression, some EQ, some noise reduction, background reduction, and then just spit it out as an MP3 and it's done. It takes me about 20 minutes, 25 minutes tops.
Right, yeah, so it's a really efficient way of doing it if you know your way around that then.
Yeah, and I know some people that do it this way, and I also know some other podcasters that like to do it the other way, which is they record just their vocals and they like to edit it all afterwards and do all that stuff, which is, you know, fair enough. But for me, I just find that I haven't got the time to sit there for 2 hours of an evening. And I mean, I have, but you know, it just sucks up your time when you could be doing something else. One thing to bear in mind with doing it this way is that you will need to spend more money.
Yeah.
Obviously. So if you're just starting out and you just want to get going, just using a basic microphone into the computer and then doing the edit afterwards is a real cheap and easy way to get going.
Yeah, absolutely. How does the, how long does it take for you to, you were saying about an hour, but how many days in advance do you tend to do the recording before you put it onto the show itself, ready for airing? How long is the gap there?
So what we normally do is sort of the process briefly for a week, if you like, would be on a Monday. I will throw out on social media a post saying, right, this week we're reviewing this show. So we'd like, because our show is quite listener orientated, so we like to get listeners' reviews and comments in and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So on a Monday, I throw that out and ask for listeners' reviews and thoughts on the review that the episode that we're reviewing that week.
Yeah.
And then on the Wednesday, it's either a Wednesday morning or afternoon, Adam and I will sit down and record that week's show on the Wednesday. And that normally takes anywhere from an hour and a half to just over 2 hours, depending on how much news or merchandise review, you know, stuff we want to talk about in the show and stuff. So that's done on a Wednesday. And then I'll either get the show sorted out in terms of editing and just polishing the audio and stuff, either that evening or the following evening on a Thursday. And then by Thursday evening, I would have had the show queued up and ready to go. And it gets put out on 7 a.m. on a Friday morning UK time. And the way that I do that is I host the audio files with Libsyn.
Yeah.
But I don't use their, what do you call it? I don't use their publishing tools, if you like.
Right.
I have a cool plugin. So our website is run on WordPress. And I've got this cool plugin called PowerPress.
Right.
Which has been around for years, and a lot of people use that. So that actually posts the article on the website with the MP3 file sort of built into it.
Right, okay.
And as a result of that, the RSS feed for our show then gets updated, and that's how things like iTunes and the other podcast directories pick our show up, because they monitor the RSS feed, and as soon as there's a new update to that. That's when it goes live.
Right.
So that's roughly our process. And we haven't deviated from that for so long. I think when we first started out, I don't know, I think our show went out on a Monday or a Wednesday. I can't remember. Yeah, but our show's gone out on a Friday for so long now.
And you mentioned something that I would like to pick up on just before we move into the Modern Who era, but something I would pick up on your episode on the first episode of this season that's just come out, that and I completely agree with this, that the giving it that little bit of time as well, even though you were on a Friday, Doctor Who used to always go out on a Saturday, it goes out on a Sunday now. But you're giving, especially those episodes that have come out live, that you've given yourselves a bit of time to digest the episode and get a bit of distance and look at the episode a bit more objectively than others may do. Was that a choice that you had in mind just to make sure you get that objectivity?
Yes, it was. Yeah. So we've toyed with sort of move. Like I said, we used to put our show out on a different... I apologise, I can't remember for the life of me what day we used to do it years ago.
Yeah, that's fine, yeah.
But we have toyed with the idea of moving it forward to be a bit more timely.
Yeah.
But I think that was more based on... And this is a much bigger subject to talk about, which we won't probably have time for, but that was based purely on my sort of sense of I want to be in with the mix. That makes sense. I want to be in there with all the other Doctor Who blogs and podcasts and YouTubers who are putting out all their videos nice and quickly after the episode.
Yeah.
But then really, as soon as that popped into my head, I sort of disregarded it really, because for two reasons. One, we've never been the kind of show or podcast to follow other shows, you know.
Right.
We've never been like following the crowd. We've always been, you know, fairly comfortable with what we're doing, and we've never felt like, oh, we should change this because this other podcast is doing it, or we should, you know, change stuff.
Yeah.
And the second reason is, like I said on the episode, and as you just mentioned, it gives us time to sort of let the dust settle and watch it a few times and not react on hype, if you like. So,
yeah,
you know, I know a couple of YouTube channels and a couple of other podcasts who will put their review out literally, you know, within minutes or hours after the episode going out on TV. And then when you see them talking in socials, maybe a week or months later or whatever, you see them talking about it and you think, well, that's not what you said when you put the review out fairly quick. So, you know, I think that's true of everybody, though. It's easy to, especially with Doctor Who, it's become, fortunately, a bit of a TV event again, which is great. So everybody's talking about it. And so as soon as the episode's finished on TV, Twitter just blows up with, you know, thousands of Who fans just, you know, putting their opinions out there and discussing it, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
But I think as a reviewer, sometimes it's easy, even if you don't think you are, it's easy to get swept along with that a little bit. And so I think your sort of true thoughts on it and review is a little bit skewed. So that's why we like to leave it, you know, literally it's almost a week later after that episode's gone out, but we don't mind that. So it gives us a good chance to digest everything. But yeah, we did toy with it previously. We had a good relationship with the BBC a couple of years ago, and they put us on their, sorry, that makes it sound like we don't anymore. We do have a good relationship with the BBC, but they put us on the preview program a couple of years ago where we would get the episode sort of two or three nights before it went out on TV.
Right.
So we would watch it then, and Adam and I were like, well, what should we do? Because something that's quite popular is for podcasters and YouTubers to do this spoiler-free preview review thing. And we toyed with that as well. We tried a few things and it just didn't seem to fit our, you know, more comfortable approach to it. So, we said to the, Beeb, after, cause they said to us, you know, we're not going to put you on the preview program anymore. And we were like, oh, that's cool. You know, but we don't really want to we're not making use of it anyway. You know, so we just, you know, we let that be, and then, we just carried on as we are, and it seems to be working pretty well. So,
The one thing that I adored was the 50th anniversary episode, which was on broadcaster cinemas, and I work in a cinema, and we got the drive a good 3 weeks before, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks before, but you couldn't, it's encrypted, so you can't play it. And what happens in cinemas is that you get the files to say, you know, likes of Star Wars Force Awakens. I did it for Star Wars Force Awakens as well, which is great. That they release the key about 24 hours before. But this was, I think the day of the Doctor was about 72 hours. It became live at midnight. So we, I decided that I needed to test that, as you do. So and my cinema screen's a 60-foot cinema screen as well. So it's similar to an IMAX screen. So it was a delight to be able to watch the Day of the Doctor on a massive screen, and you know, before everyone else. And obviously you got all the letters from, I think it was Stephen Moffat, was Day of the Doctor, wasn't it? So Stephen Moffat actually sent a letter out to all cinemas saying, please make sure it works, but please don't put anything on social media, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was a wonderful little present that I got given for the Day of the Doctor, and I loved that episode anyway. Okay, so from that was kind of how it all comes together, and that's, your podcast is all up and running now, so you're 205 episodes in, 206 episodes in, and the majority of that, I'm assuming that you started off in 2014 with the Modern Who. Was that how your first few episodes were? Was it on the current Doctor at the time?
No. So when I first started, you tested my memory now. I think when I first started, I think I did a bunch of classic Who reviews, right, to begin with.
Yeah.
I remember, oh crikey. So I think episode one was, I think it was The Caves of Androzani, which is an old sort of Peter Davison story. I think, crikey. I'm pretty sure it was a bunch of classic Who. I don't think Doctor Who was on at the time. I remember that.
Right.
I don't think it was on, the series wasn't going out at the time. I think it had finished. I think one of Matt Smith's... Yeah, it must have been Matt Smith's era. So his series would have finished at the time. Yeah, so I think I did a sort of a mix to begin with. But that might have been the reason why, because there was no new Doctor Who on the TV at the time.
Yeah.
I just dove back in and just grabbed a mix of, because when I started getting into Doctor Who, I really dived into the classic era as much as the modern stuff. So, yeah, I think I grabbed a mix of stuff for the first few.
So talking about the classic stuff then, I'm apart from the Sylvester McCoy, and I think maybe a couple of others I've come across, I haven't delved into the classic stuff. And, you know, we mentioned this before about it being in the British consciousness, and I remember seeing clips and whatever. But if you were to choose a couple of episodes, maybe three episodes in the classic era for someone to watch, what would they be to get a flavour of what the classic episodes would be?
Wow, just three. So I think it more depends on, actually no, I was going to say, I think it depends more on what type of Doctor you want to start watching, but that's not really fair because they've all got sort of strong and weak episodes, really. I think
if they think about it a different way, then what episodes hold up the best in sort of the modern day TV? So which episodes would you consider that hold up over the test of time, rather than it looks tired or it looks a bit dated? I think, put it that way.
Yeah, so even some of the early black and white stuff looks quite good today. So so actually, surprisingly, the very first episode, An Unearthly Child, episode 1, 1, 1 of 1,
yeah,
is that doesn't look too bad. Right. And some of the other, one of the episodes that we reviewed on the show at some point, I think The War Machines from the first Doctor's era, that looks quite cool. So even some of those early black and white ones can look pretty good. And then as you go through classic Who, it's a bit of a roller coaster, really, because, The War Machines is a great episode from the first Doctor's era, as is the first one, An Unearthly Child. That's good. And then when you get into the second Doctor, there's a couple of cracking stories there. The Web of Fear is really good. Right. The War Games, Troughton's regeneration story. That's a bit long, but it's a great story. And then when you get into the colour episodes of Doctor Who, so John Pertwee's era.
Yeah.
It's a real roller coaster, because the very first, with his very first story, Spearhead from Space, that was filmed on proper film stock. as opposed to the old TV tapes that they used to use. Yeah. So the picture quality is fantastic, and they did a remaster and they released it on Blu-ray and high def and stuff. So that holds up very well. That looks great. But then as you get into the earlier, as you go through, sorry, the earlier Pertwee series, the picture quality is a bit ropey. It's a bit fuzzy, and you know, the quality is just not great. And then when you get into Tom Baker's era, it's fairly consistent, really. So Tom Baker being one of the most popular doctors, I would say, you know, everyone recognizes the multicolored scarf and the hat and stuff. But in terms of episodes, I mean, there's a whole bunch you could pick from his era that are great. You've got things like Genesis of the Daleks is always a popular one. The Talons of Wang Chiang. One of my favorites, The Brain of Morbius.
Okay.
The Brain of Morbius. His era is fairly consistent in terms of sort of picture quality and production values. There are a few where you can tell, because Doctor Who's never had a lot of money.
That's
evident, especially throughout the classic era. So there are some episodes where that's more, you know, it's indicative of the time. So there's a saying, you know, that across lots of Who fans about wobbly sets, where when someone closes a door, the whole set wobbles, and you can just tell that there's not much money. But
yeah, and that will give it its charm in some ways as well, though, doesn't it?
Really? Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's one of the things that makes it so fantastic to watch throughout the classic era, is that not relying on, you know, high-end visual effects or practical effects. It's just about the brilliant stories and how well it's written and the actors and so on. So, I mean, I could pick out loads. I mean, the Pyramids of Mars is another brilliant one from Tom Baker's era. And then Peter Davison's era, that's fairly consistent as well. It looks fairly similar to the later sort of Tom Baker years.
Yeah.
Nothing crazy in terms of visual effects. A few of them were okay. In my opinion, and a lot of people's opinion, his greatest story is his last one, which is The Caves of Androzani, his regeneration story.
Right.
Is pretty good, but they're, you know, he didn't stick around as long as, you know, Tom Baker. And then Colin Baker's era, poor old Colin. I mean, if you ask, Doctor Who fans who their favorite doctors are, if you ask like a million Doctor Who fans, unfortunately, his Colin Baker falls quite low down on the list quite regularly. Which is, you know, awful, really, because he, in some ways, he's a cracking doctor, and he's done, you know, some fantastic stories and so on. And his, in terms of how well his episodes stand up, most of them do in terms of quality, I suppose. I mean, the budget certainly hasn't got any less, but it hasn't got any more, if that makes sense. It's a sort of consistent thing. But, you know, as you go through time, as you go through the different eras of Doctor Who and stuff, you can see that, you know, camera equipment has moved on a little bit and audio quality is a little bit better and so on.
Yeah.
And you get that with the modern stuff. Now, the modern stuff came in 2005 when we had, as you mentioned before, Christopher Eccleston took it on and brought it to a new generation of people, with Russell T. Davis, and eventually Stephen Moffat took over as the showrunner. And without going into too much detail over that, but the modern Who era is now, it's been going for 13, almost 14 years now. And you just think, and I was looking at this the other day and thought, my, it started when I was 25, and I was quite shocked. I thought it was must have been much later than that, but it has. It's kind of in back into the consciousness of people, and in a similar way, there has been seasons in the modern Who where you can see money has gone down, or CGI has not been fantastic, and it's gone up and down, and it's the same old. I mean, sci-fi is a difficult one anyway. I mean, I've recently been discussing Babylon 5. I haven't watched it. I've watched two or three episodes. I couldn't get with it because of the CGI problems with it. It just didn't work for me. But the models of Star Trek are a completely different matter completely. And but it isn't that bad that it's off-putting, but sometimes you look at the show and go, it's getting tired, or it's not really quite there. You've the modern era has got some great showrunners in Russell T. Davis and Stephen Moffat. And then obviously now we've got, I'll probably ruin his name, but Chris Chibnall. Is that how you say it? Chibnall?
Chibnall, yep.
Chibnall, yep. So Chris Chibnall's just taken over. We're, as we speak, we have four episodes into the modern era. Now, my preference, we mentioned X-Files before, but my preference on show writing is to have these convoluted, timey-wimey. I love Heaven Sent. I think Heaven Sent is a brilliant episode. I love that episode.
Okay.
But I like high concepts anyway. So the fact that, you know, X-Files has got an episode called Monday, which is similar, cause and effect on Star Trek Next Generation. Groundhog Day is a perfect example of that. Mm-hmm. I love those type of concept episodes, and Heaven Sent for me was fantastic. And I love that type of thing. But what I've seen of the first four episodes of the new season, it seems to be a bit more straight, grounded. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen for the next six, but it seems to be as if the story is going to be drip-fed to us over the course of the season, but it's going to be a fairly straightforward story. Do you agree with that? And how did you feel that the difference between Russell T. Davis, Moffat, and, as we say, the few episodes of Chibnall that we've seen, what are your kind of thoughts and what are your preferences over that run over the last 14 years?
The difference between the showrunners is, in a way, it's hard to pick out and identify in a way, because I think it comes down to those showrunners and what their key qualities are as writers, really. And you can see that across a bunch of different stories in each of their eras. But it's hard to pick out. Yeah, mate, you're right. So in terms of, because the whole team at the BBC, obviously, there's a lot of creative input and a lot of people working on it. So it's difficult sometimes to credit something to one of the showrunners when actually it was somebody else that was, you know, responsible for that. But there are key things that you can pick out from each era. So Russell's era, one thing that we mention on the show all the time is that he's so good at writing and creating characters and writing interactions for those characters.
Right, yeah.
So a lot of the writers that he had on board in his era were fantastic at writing really good sort of science fiction stories and stuff. And you can tell that Russell was responsible for a lot of the character stuff.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so much about writing these. You mentioned with Chibnall's era, the episodes we've seen so far, that it feels like we're going to be drip-fed this story throughout the series. I mean, that was something that Stephen Moffat did a lot.
Yeah.
Where we'd have these big sort of overarching story, like these story arcs that went across the entire season. And Russell did that to an extent, but it wasn't so... It wasn't in your face as much as Moffat did. Mm. So I don't know if you remember or rewatched any of the RTD stuff, but we had the Bad Wolf thing that ran through with Rose,
and I thought that was brilliantly done. But it's for that was kind of, I think J.J. Abrams does that quite a lot as well. But that was kind of placing things in the show to call back to. I think Moffat was more, as you said there, more detailed in what he was doing with it.
Yeah. So the way that RTD did that, it was more subtle, so that when you got to the end of the series, it was one of those, oh, moments, you know, everything sort of clicked into place and you thought, oh, you know, a bit of a genius, you know, because although you had those moments in some of the episodes and Rose and kept seeing Bad Wolf and stuff, it wasn't one of those moments where you thought, oh, just get on with it. You know, it was really cool to have that big sort of coming together at the end. But the way that the Moff did things was that it felt sometimes like that the series was sort of buckling under the pressure a little bit of this big story arc that was, he was desperate for people to you know, it felt like he was desperate for viewers to be aware of it 100%. There was no, you know, because sometimes it's cool as I imagine anyway, as a writer, to just let viewers have their own mind, sort of concoct their own versions of what's going on in the background.
Yeah.
So you don't have to be explicit and direct all the time. You know, sometimes it's cool just to let people, you know, it's like discussions in the pub or whatever. Yeah. It's like, what do you think is going to happen with this and stuff? Whereas the Moth, it almost felt like he wanted to do away with that. And it's like, right, this is happening and I want you to be fully aware of it, you know, and this is coming up and we've got, you know, so that was, and that's the difference between Russell, I think, and Stephen Moffat, is that Russell was brilliant at the character stuff and relied on his other writers to do the great story stuff, like Paul Cornell. Gareth Roberts wrote a few good ones. Keith Temple and so on. So they wrote some cool stories for him, so he could, you know, he trusted them to bring all that stuff together. Whereas the Moth is pretty terrible at writing character stuff. You know, so he was great when he wrote a few episodes for RTD, these era, actually, he was pretty good. So he wrote one of the real popular ones. He wrote Blink.
All right, yeah.
For RTD's era, and he created the Weeping Angels. You know, that was all out of his mind, and you know, he's done some great stuff. And Silence in the Library as well. That's a brilliant episode.
Yeah.
And the two part of the Forest of the Dead that goes with it. You know, so he's wrote some great stuff. But when he was the showrunner, you know, it was like, you know, he's like, it almost felt like you should just concentrate on keeping the train moving.
Yeah.
And just keep your fingers out of the pies, so to speak. And now Chris Chibnall, he seems to be bringing a sense of story arc stuff to the new series, but in a bit more sort of RTD vein, really. He seems to be a bit more subtle about it, and just let's see how the course of the series goes, and we'll see if it comes together at the end. Because, as we know, he was fantastic at the sort of whodunit thing for Broadchurch.
Yeah.
So he really knows his stuff in terms of, you know, let's pan the story out over a series. Let's not be so direct like the Moth did.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, each showrunner's definitely brought their own sort of flavour, obviously, to each era of Doctor Who. I think it's just, they've got their strengths and weaknesses, and it's a little bit too early to tell, I think, at the moment for Chibnall what his main strength is going to be. And it feels like his strength is, like Russell's, is characters. It feels like, because the companions this series have definitely got rave reviews and everyone's really on board and they're very relatable and very good to watch. So it feels like he's going to be more like Russell, where it's about the characters and the interactions. And
yeah, because the dynamic, I was just about to talk about that as well, actually. The dynamic of the companions over these four episodes have been really, really good. I think Yaz has been probably the one that's had least time, but I'm sure that we'll get that as we go along. But the one thing that I was saying about them, drip feeding over the course of the season, was very much on last Sunday's episode, which was the Arachnids in the UK, which was the spider episode. And the scenes which have been coming up with Grace and Graham in the house, and I thought that was absolutely brilliantly played. I think Bradley Walsh has been an absolute star on so far on the episodes, and I just think he's been absolutely brilliant. And the little things that they're putting in, that they're developing, like we find Yaz's family for the first time. So we're in episode four now. We've had the regeneration episode, we've had to find the TARDIS episode, and we've had a fantastic episode in Rosa about Rosa Parks. I think that signals to me that this is going to be a great season, just purely for the fact that each of the episodes haven't been bad. They've all been better than average, at least, and I think that they've been solid episodes. Some of the story itself for me haven't been strong, but they have been really focusing on the characters, and that's why I think that Arachnids really worked quite well. And I would say that Arachnids was a bit on the nose with the whole Trump and Star Trek thing.
A little bit, yep.
And I am looking forward to seeing what your review is going to be, because that will come out before this comes out, so it'll be interesting to see what your thoughts are on that. But over the four episodes, what have been your pros and cons so far that you've seen?
So it feels like I agree with you. I think the stories so far haven't been, with the exception of Rosa, I think the stories haven't been groundbreaking. It's not. I don't think they're the stories that will be necessarily talked about a lot over the years. I think we've got so many awesome stuff to come from this Doctor and from Chibnall's era.
Yeah.
I just think at the moment it feels like, I mean, in terms of, I'll come on to strong points in a second, but in terms of weaknesses, there aren't many, but it very much feels like the show's finding its feet a little bit. And especially Jodie Whittaker, it feels like she's kind of hasn't really found, I mean, don't get me wrong, she's brilliant. She's absolutely brilliant as the Doctor, but it just feels like she hasn't found her groove just yet. She's very much, she's almost there. And some people would say, well, that's a bit critical to say that because she's only just started and we're only at episode 4 and so on. But if you think about the previous Doctors, all in the modern era, I'm talking about. So those guys, you know, especially Matt Smith, I think out of all of those guys, Matt Smith, from his very first episode, The 11th Hour, he was the Doctor, like within seconds, you know, and he found his groove. And it wasn't one of those breaking in periods where after 4 or 5 episodes, you're like, right now he's, you know, developing his character and he's finding his groove. I don't think Jodie Whittaker's quite there yet. And I'm not necessarily her fault. I think maybe the writing's been a little bit sort of skew. The writing's been a little bit all over the place, not in terms of consistency, but there are some episodes where, especially the first one, The Woman Who Fell to Earth, she was very giddy and zany and crazy. And, you know, some, you can argue that some of that is because
the regeneration.
Precisely. Right. Yeah. Some doctors are a little bit sort of nuts. But you would have thought that by now in episode 4, that the writing would have been, you know, that some of them, she's very, in some scenes, she's quite chatty. She talks very, very fast and she's very zany. And in other scenes, which are beautiful, where she's a bit slower and a bit more reserved. Yeah. So I think we just need to find a sort of middle ground of those two.
I mean, I think as well that it's unusual that the ensembles become more of a thing than the Doctor, really. She's not taking a back seat as such, because she isn't. But it's, you're getting to know 4 or 5 different characters, as well as, which I think might be a bit towards it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a bit like the Davison era, back when we had a slightly busier TARDIS team, if you like, where there's 3 or 4 companions along with the Doctor. And yeah, you're right. You know, we're trying to get to know and relate to not just the Doctor, but the other companions as well.
Yeah.
So I think it's I mean, it's not really a negative in a way. It just feels like the show has not. It's definitely found what it wants to be. I think the new, because when The Moth took over and when Matt Smith started, and we had a completely new look and feel and a new logo and theme and everything, the show, in the same way that it's done now, it's found what it wants to be. There's no experimentation needed. It's just the stories themselves and some of the writing. I think needs to be tightened up a bit and not polished, because I think one of the qualities of Doctor Who is that it doesn't need to feel like, you know, amazingly 100% polished. It has a rawness to it sometimes, which is its appeal.
Just like it needs another draft of it.
Another draft. And I think that goes back to what I was saying earlier about the way that Chibnall's writing at the moment, because he's written for Doctor Who in the past, and they haven't really been the best episodes in terms of story. And it would have been, and Chibnall's actually written about half of these. When Adam and I spoke on our last show, or the show before that, we were surprised because we thought he only wrote the first two and the last one.
Right.
But he actually wrote Arachnids in the UK, and he's written the follow-up as well.
Right.
For next this Sunday show. So it would have been nice for him to... And, sorry, Rosa was co-written. He's got co-written credit on that as well. Yeah. So I think it would have been nice for him to sort of relax a bit early on. I think bring in some more writers to write potentially those ones. I think the showrunner always writes the opening and the closing ones. Mm. That's been the pattern, I think, over... since Modern Who came back, and I think it would have been nice for him to relax the reins a little bit after his opening couple of episodes, and because he got some, you know, some cool people on board.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I think by the end of this first series for Jodie, I think I think it will be consistent in terms of her first series will be great, a great first series, but it won't be, like I said, it won't be stuff that people will be talking about, with the exception of things like potentially Rosa.
Yeah.
And we'll see what the finale is like. I think we'll be talking more about the characters.
Yeah. Oh, I think that absolutely. I think it's a good start, and what I've noticed as well is the production on it's a lot higher as well.
Crazy.
So yeah, the some of the direction's been really good, and it feels like it's gone up a few notches, and I think that they've ploughed up money in, and I think that the ratings have not done too bad. I saw on Twitter yesterday that Arachnids was about 6.4 million, I think somewhere around there. So it's doing really well, and I think that it needed to be freshened up. I'm a big Doctor Who fan. I clear my schedule Christmas Day. There's no one talks to me on Christmas Day around 6-7 o'clock at night. I've literally got to the point of saying everyone either get out or I'm going somewhere else, and that's always been a big thing for me. I've always struggled because of my lifestyle to watch it when it airs, which is a shame. But I find it a fascinating show, and I do love it to bits. I do have the DVDs, and it's one of those ones that I will eventually go back to and rewatch. And I think that it's fantastic that the likes of yourselves are reviewing it, and it's certainly something that I would like to go back to, and with many podcasts that I listen to a review about a particular episode after rewatching one, just to get a new view on it. So it's certainly something that I would certainly do. Before we finish, though, I heard on one of your podcasts that you've got quite a bit of merchandise. I'm just wondering what types of merchandise do you consider your favourites, and what would you never ever part with?
Yeah, we do have, between Adam and I, we do have a fairly substantial whack of merch. I've actually slowed down in the past year, I would say.
Right.
Mainly because I haven't got the room anymore to display it. Because I think there are two types of merchandise collectors. There are people who like to keep everything boxed and pristine.
Yeah.
And they're the other people like me who don't care for that and just want to get it unboxed and displayed on the shelf. But as a result of that, I can't pack it away in boxes anymore. I need to display it. So I only pick up stuff now that's like if I fall in love with it, basically, and think, you know, I have to have it. So I've slowed down a bit. But in terms of stuff that I've got, favorite stuff would be, I've got this really cool little prop. It's the Siege Mode TARDIS,
right?
Which is from a company called Rubber Toe Props. And it's essentially, in one of Capaldi's episodes, the TARDIS turned into this little cube.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and it looks gorgeous. I mean, Rubber Toe, they always do really, I mean, it's expensive, but they do really high quality, really detailed props and stuff. So that's really cool. I've got a while ago, they did this television remote in the style of Matt Smith and David Tennant's sonic screwdrivers. Right. So I've got the 10th Doctor's sonic screwdriver, but it's a television remote. And as a result of that, it feels heavier and it's a higher quality.
Right.
But the stand is awesome. It's like a little sort of gray disc with a magnet on it so that the sonic stands up on its end, which looks awesome. And I've got some signed stuff as well, which I love. So I've got some DVD covers and some pictures that I've, when I've met the actors at conventions or so on, I've got them to sign it. So my sign stuff is quite cool. I like that. And also a couple of bits from, there's a company called Robert Harrop who make these wonderful little sort of polystone characters. So I've got a couple of those. I've got the Sea Devil, which looks beautiful. And I've also got the Special Weapons Dalek from the McCoy story, Remembrance of the Daleks.
Okay.
So those two look absolutely beautiful. I love the Robert Harrop stuff.
Brilliant.
And apart from that, it's just a ton of sort of, I've got quite a few TARDIS collectibles and just a ton of books and other stuff, really. But
yeah,
I've slowed down a bit.
Oh, good. Well, not good, but you'll just have to. You'll have to when you win the lottery, you'll have to just buy a house just purely to put your stuff in, I think.
That'd be amazing.
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Well, Gary, thank you very much for coming on. It's much appreciated. We will see how this transpires, this season transpires, and hopefully we'll have a wonderful season to look back on. But anyone who is listening, please check out Gary's podcast. You won't be disappointed. It's both yourself and Adam have fantastic discussions, and I really enjoyed the knowledge of both of you. And it's fantastic to find podcasts like yourself. So again, thank you very much, Gary, for coming on, and we'll speak to you at some point soon.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you very much for having me on, and best of luck with your podcast. Hope it goes well.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Gary.